Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Philip Drew, administrator. And our next guest is Karen Kwiatkowski. Oh, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. She is a recently retired lieutenant colonel from the United States Air Force. Her final position was a political military affairs officer in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, Undersecretary for Policy in the Sub-Saharan Africa and Near East South Asia Policy Directorates. While at NESA, she worked the North Africa desk in the sister office to the Office of Special Plans. Before that, she served on the Air Force Staff Operations Directorate at the Pentagon and the staff of the Director of the National Security Agency at Fort Meade, Maryland. Oh, I might be in over my head here. She has authored two recent books on African issues, African Crisis Response Initiative, Past, Present, and Future, and Expeditionary Air Operations in Africa, Challenges and Solutions. She also teaches college classes and writes for Lou Rockwell. .com. Welcome to the show, Mrs. Kwiatkowski.
I'm very glad to be here.
And am I pronouncing your name correctly?
It's Kwiatkowski.
Oh, okay, that's easy then. easier than I was sounding it out as. Okay, now, before we get started here, I need to correct a mistake that I made last week. I interviewed Jim Loeb from Interpress Service, and we talked about how there was an article in The Nation by a reporter named Bob Dreyfus about the Office of Special Plans and how there was at least the possibility that it was created as a subsidiary, basically, of an Office of Special Plans set up in the Prime Minister of Israel's, Ariel Sharon's, in his office. And now there was an article by Jim Loeb, which talked about the article in The Nation, and which also referred to you as mentioning that you had escorted some Israelis to Douglas Feith's office. And I think my words were that this partially corroborated what it said in The Nation, and what I didn't say was that you never came to the conclusion, you never said anything that would imply that you thought that this had something directly to do with an Office of Special Plans in Israel and an Office of Special Plans here. And
right.
I want to make sure that I get that straight, because I made too much of a conclusion, and perhaps even sounded like I was putting words in your mouth, which I did not mean to do. And truthfully, on further thinking about it, taking some Israelis to Douglas Feith's office isn't even really partial cooperation, much less confirmation of the fact of a tie in the Office of Special Plans to Israel. So I just wanted to get my screw-up from last week out of the way there. And then maybe you can tell us exactly what was going on there and what wasn't.
Okay. What was going on up there in the Office of Special Plans? Well, it was started, when they set the office up, they told us it would be the expanded Iraq desk. So they were definitely focusing on Iraq, all things to do with Iraq. Now, again, you realize this is the Office of Secretary of Defense. We have a whole military structure that does war planning. Basically, the Central Command would be the primary for war planning in Iraq, and as a support to them, you would have the Joint Staff, which is filled with operational military officers who understand war planning. The Office of Secretary of Defense historically does not get involved in war fighting and war planning. And I just wanted to make that clear, because there was a great deal of involvement in the Iraq planning by the Office of Secretary of Defense through this Office of Special Plans. Whether they were doing operational planning is unclear, but what they were busy doing was making the persuasive argument that we really needed to do this, that there is an imminent threat, that there is a threat that is a threat to the United States proper, that this threat will be very destructive and dangerous to the United States if we don't do something right away. They very much focused on creating the propaganda story that was used both by President Bush and Vice President Cheney to convince the American people. And also, they propagandized us inside of the building. And that's very interesting, because normally you don't, people inside the Pentagon don't necessarily need to be convinced of something. You know, we follow orders. But the propaganda was also directed at us. One of the products that the Office of Special Plans did was a set of talking points on Iraq, WMD, and Al-Qaeda, or terrorism in general. And these talking points were produced by the Office of Special Plans once it had been set up in August of 2002. We were told to use them and not just use them as a guide in papers that we might write, but to use them verbatim, not to eliminate anything, to absolute, basically cut and paste from their document into any document we were preparing verbatim. And we couldn't use them twice. We could only use them at the time we asked for them. And then if a couple weeks later we needed to do another paper, a read-ahead, a background paper, anything like that, we would have to call back up and get the latest version, which would be different. It would be minor changes as this thing went through. And as I looked at these talking points, I'm used to reading intelligence, which is written in a very objective way, in a way that tells you you're confident in what they're saying. They don't go out on a limb, make crazy predictions. And then there's information that's designed to persuade and propagandize, and that's what we were getting from the Office of Special Plans. It was very similar to the kinds of things that President Bush and Vice President Cheney were saying in speeches, but it's surprising that you would see that kind of, you know, it's understandable that the politicians would do that to the American people. What's not understandable is why they would do that to us inside of the Pentagon.
Well, and didn't they think that you could tell the difference between an intelligence report and some talking points? And that,
well, that's a real good question.
They'd be alienating you by insulting mm-hmm. your intelligence and such.
Actually, that's a great question, because they already had discounted and were not involving in their planning the professional military and the professional civilian side of policy. The folks working on Iraq stuff that were the key people that were making the decisions and writing the paper and creating these propaganda points and working closely with the Office of Vice President, all those people, not all of them, I would say 90% of them, were political appointees. And of those 90% political appointees, they came from a very small handful of neoconservative think tanks. Okay, we had some from American Enterprise Institute. You had some that were members of the Project for New American Century. You had folks that had been involved with the Center for Security Policy. And then, of course, there's a couple of Israeli-funded think tanks that were also able to provide political appointees. So they had a group of folks they trusted, and they didn't need to propagandize those folks because they were all on board with the agenda, which was, of course, to hurry up, get Saddam out of there, occupy Iraq, and build four bases. Okay, so they're doing that. The rest of us in the Pentagon, the professional corps, whether it was civilian or military, were pretty much cut out anyway. So, yes, it would seem like if they had been working with us closely, that would have come across as an insult to our intelligence, and maybe it would have alienated us, but they weren't working with us closely. They would basically, it was very clear, it was just a symptom, them giving us those talking points that were propagandistic and developed to persuade, with just one more example of how we weren't part of the team.
Well, that's interesting. They were so far removed from, or they removed themselves so far from the rest of the professionals in the Pentagon that mm-hmm. it didn't even occur to them, really, that it mattered what you thought or...
Exactly, and it did not. It did not matter what we thought. You got to realize, when you look at the development of the invasion strategy, not so much the operational military strategy, but the political strategy to convince the American people to get behind this invasion and eventual occupation of Iraq, certainly the regime change of Saddam Hussein and the putting in place of a friendly government, whether that means, you know, Jerry Bremer, obviously he's pretty friendly, or somebody like Ahmed Shalabi, who had certainly expected at one point in time to be in charge of Iraq. This is the plan. But you got to realize, they've had the folks, the political appointees who occupy the Pentagon, the Wolfowitzes, the Pearls, the Doug Feist, Undersecretary for Policy. Well, we could go there, yeah. But the folks that are doing this, and Dick Cheney, of course, and Scooter Libby, and all these folks that had been, during the Clinton years, working in their think tanks with each other, developing their strategies and plans and opinions. As those folks moved into the Pentagon, they just continued on with plans and strategies that they had long held, things that they had written about in 1996. Richard Perle and Doug Feist wrote a document called A Clean Break, Strategy for Securing the Realm. It was written for Bibi Netanyahu when he was running for office, I believe, and it forecasted or predicted or declared that in order to improve Israel's condition, we had to take care of Syria and Iran, and the first step to do that would be by putting in a friendly government of some kind in Iraq. Okay, whether that's an occupation government or some other kind of hand-picked government, that's what you need to do. Of course, that's what we've, in some ways, you could say we have that in Iraq. Of course, it's not the rest of the country is not very friendly, but in a sense we have a friendly government there. But the plan for this was not so much a detailed plan, but certainly the fact that this was on the agenda. This was written by Pearl and Feist and David Wormser, who now is with the Office of the Vice President. Before that he was with the State Department. Before that he was with the Pentagon. These folks wrote this in 1996. Okay? 1998, again, 1998, long time ago, during the Clinton administration, the Project for a New American Century sent a letter signed by a whole bunch of people that are in the administration right now, sent a letter to Bill Clinton saying he needed to act on Saddam Hussein to displace him and put a friendly government in the place of Saddam Hussein's dictatorship. So this is something they've been thinking about, working on, and talking about with each other for a long, 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 long time. Okay, it didn't just come up. And that's something that people, I don't think, really understand. So for most people, when the president started talking about mushroom clouds, you know, unmanned aerial vehicles that were going to deliver weapons of mass destruction, when George Bush is talking about Saddam Hussein is going to give weapons to Al-Qaeda, forget the fact that they didn't work together in any case. When George Bush started saying that, it sounded very scary. But you got to realize it was all part of a longer-held strategy. And that strategy is all out there. Excuse me?
The road to Damascus lies through Baghdad.
That's exactly right. And the reason people quote that and use that phrase is because many of the neocons have said that. Okay, they themselves have said that. This is not a secret, and it's not something that's hidden. The neoconservatives have been, in some ways, very, very open about what it is that they envision for the Middle East, okay, and the role that they envision for the United States, which is, unfortunately, for the rest of the Americans, and certainly for soldiers in our military, and airmen and sailors and Marines, very unfortunate for them. But what the neoconservative vision calls for is an imperial America, okay, an empire. It brings with it a whole bunch of baggage. It's not part of the traditional American vision of foreign policy. It's not something Americans want to do. It's not something that George Bush asked Americans, would you like to elect me because I will make America the master of the empire. George Bush did not run on that platform. As you remember, he said we wanted to have a foreign policy of humility. He contrasted himself with Bill Clinton's interventionism. Okay, so this is why anybody who voted for Bush certainly found that was appealing to them. Of course, that's not what we got. Okay, what we're getting, what Bush is delivering to us through these, you know, by listening to all these neoconservative advisors that he has, is basically the development of the United States empire.
Well, in fact, in your interview in the Sydney Morning Herald, you said that President Bush isn't in control of his administration, that his entire White House has been hijacked by this group of neocons.
Mm-hmm. Well, definitely the evidence is, and this is if you want to be kind to George Bush, okay? I want to be kind to George Bush if I can do that, okay? Don't ask me why. But I have a feeling that I should give him a little credit, very little. But if I look at the whole situation, the positions that he ran on seemed to me to be sincere. I could be wrong, but he seemed like he was speaking in a sincere manner. And after 9/11, the neoconservative global plan, which starts in the Middle East but it didn't end there, was basically, it had a great opportunity to get kick-started, and guys like Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz on the 12th of September 2001 are talking about Iraq. We don't care if there's evidence, dig up stuff on Iraq, because Iraq is our enemy, as we know because we wrote all these papers in 96 and 98 and 2000, we've been working on this, right? So Iraq is our enemy, we need to find evidence so that we can use this energization of the United States' sensitivity to threat, okay, which is, we were definitely sensitized to threat, I think, after 9/11. But that was manipulated and focused and used by the neoconservatives. And they're placed in such a way that they could be powerful. Now, one thing that's interesting, I think, if you look at where these neoconservatives are, there's a couple over in the State Department, but Colin Powell, of course, is not one. You have John Bolton working in the arms control area, but he works for Colin Powell, technically. You have a whole bunch of them in the Pentagon, okay?
To put Bolton in the State Department as a foil for Colin Powell, isn't that?
Well, they certainly did. They certainly did. They needed somebody over there, and they put Bolton. And Bolton is extremely radical in many of the things that he says. He's very much a true believer, very much a classical neoconservative, if there is such a thing. Now, they've been around 40 or 50 years, but I would still call him a classical neoconservative. He's very outspoken about what he thinks, and he does a good job for the neoconservatives at the State Department. But there's a whole bunch of them at the Pentagon. Now, technically, in the way that the bureaucracies of foreign policy and security are organized, you would look to the State Department to determine some of these things, like threats and that. The Pentagon is going to do operational threats, and quite frankly, Saddam Hussein was not a military operational threat to the United States of America. Okay? He didn't have any missiles that could reach us, right? He didn't have any WMD.
He didn't have any remote control planes that could fly.
He sure didn't. He didn't have that. You know, he didn't have nuclear weapons. He didn't have any capability to create nuclear weapons. So basically, when it comes to how the United States of America and the Department of Defense figure out who's going to be a threat, Iraq would never come up on the radar as a threat to the United States. Now, is Iraq somebody that we wanted to bomb with the no-fly zone enforcement? Sure, sure. But the country is a fourth-rate economy, okay? It was getting worse every day with the way the effectiveness of the sanctions and a whole bunch of other, the corruption, you know, the socialism that they had under that dictatorship. I mean, you know, the country's going downhill. There's no doubt about it. Getting weaker by the day, not stronger. So for the Pentagon, the only thing you're going to get from the Pentagon is this country is not a threat to the United States. We're going to focus on countries that can hurt us, like, say, for example, North Korea, okay? But that's what the Pentagon should be saying. But what was the Pentagon saying at the top level? What was Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, and Feith all saying?
Iraq.
That's right. They were saying Iraq. Now, if you had allowed the bureaucracy, if you'd listened to what the intelligence was telling you, because the CIA's intelligence was good, DIA's intelligence was good, okay? The State Department Bureau of Intelligence and Research, the products that they had were good. They haven't changed their intelligence reporting. You know, now you've got the administration pointing the finger. You've got Congress saying, hey, CIA, your information was bad. And the CIA pulls out their information, and they say, well, excuse me very much, but here's what we gave you. And it's all, this is what we knew, and this is how we presented it. And if you had looked at the whole document, you would have known that Iraq did not present a threat. Okay? But the president, you know, the administration, the vice president, Office of Special Plans, took that information out of context, cherry-picked it, you know, did a little creative writing, and basically did this propaganda flow to activate the American people and to the Congress. The Congress itself was misled. There is no doubt. And the Congress knows it right now, too. They didn't know it then. They know it now.
Well, did they not know that the Office of Special Plans had been created because the CIA wasn't lying well enough? I knew that last summer. I was reading the papers, and it said they said in the papers last summer that Cheney's made all these visits to CIA, and they won't lie enough, and so they've created this Office of Special Plans.
Well, you know, you would think, and I think that there were a couple of folks in Congress that did have a suspicion, and you know, they're the ones that are outspoken now. It's the Lugers and the Bidens and some of these guys who did have their eyes open and had some ideas about what was happening. But I think, too, that it's almost one of those things where, you know, you hear it and you see it and you go, well, that couldn't be happening. That couldn't be happening so openly. What do you mean they're pressuring for intel? Of course it didn't happen. Don't you remember Vietnam? We've learned our lesson. And people are thinking, oh, that's not really happening. That's just accusation by people that are, say, against this future war that we were going to have at that time. You know, this idea that we've already made the decision to go into Iraq. You know, maybe those people are just pointing fingers. They're picking on George Bush. You know, remember what they were called, right? What was everyone called last summer if they asked the question?
You're with the terrorists.
Well, you're with us or you're with the terrorists. You're either with George Bush or you're a terrorist. You're a domestic terrorist. You're a traitor. You could be a traitor. If you don't like it, go to another country. I think those were the things that if anyone asked the question, they were told that.
Hey, I saw the bumper sticker yesterday that said, if you don't like it, move to France.
Exactly. So there wasn't a lot of real open discussion and fair and objective discussion about what exactly was happening, and that was by design. Okay, you well know that's part of the design of this whole thing. They didn't want questions. They don't want questions now. Now, of course, you know, the Office of Special Plans has been disbanded. I don't know exactly when. I think it was a few months ago. They disbanded that office. So technically, they don't exist. They serve a particular purpose of developing arguments for this invasion, this ill-planned and ill-thought-out invasion. And now that we've got the invasion forces, we've got 130,000 troops in Iraq. I think 13. They said 13, maybe more, died. Just this morning or last night when they shut that Chinook down. So our boys and our girls, our men and women are over there, and they're dying. The Office of Special Plans is disbanded. The neoconservatives are happy as they can be. They're just as happy as they can be. They've got 130,000 troops in Iraq, four bases being built, and who do you think is building them? Who builds bases for the United States of America?
Halliburton and Beck.
Halliburton and KBR. In fact, isn't KBR down here in Texas?
Oh, Kellogg Brown and Root. Yeah, I think that's in Houston, right?
That's right. That's right. Well, they do. What do they do? You look at what they sell us. They build bases. Okay? They built bases in Bosnia. They built bases in the stands. They built bases in Afghanistan. They're building bases in Iraq. Okay? And who pays for when we build American bases? U.S. taxpayer. And that's what they're doing. Okay?
Let me stop you right there for a second, because you just mentioned Yugoslavia. I just interviewed Nebojša Samalić from the Balkan Express on Antiwar.com all about that situation.
Okay.
And I noticed that there was a column that you wrote called Steak Sauce and Triangles, where you imply in there, and I say imply because I don't think you came right out and said it, but I think you imply that the United States helped break up Yugoslavia so that we could have bases in Central Europe. Is that your opinion?
Well, I don't know if I intended to imply that. I think that, I'll tell you this. We have the European command, right? We got 100,000 troops in Germany, right? We've had them there since, some number of American troops have been in Germany since World War II. And in Germany, Germany is somewhat rural, but it's also a lot urban, right? A lot of people live in Germany. And there's a lot of restrictions on what we can do as far as flying ranges. I'm in the Air Force, so, flying and doing training missions and dropping bombs and that kind of thing, it's very, very difficult in Germany nowadays because there's many restrictions, environmental restrictions, noise restrictions, the whole bit. At the same time, the Army has increasingly found that their operations are also restricted in Germany, mainly because of the people, that live there, right? I mean, we drive our tanks through the little narrow streets and knock flower pots off the side of the houses. I mean, they complain about that, and we have to pay for that damage. So there has been, since the wall came down, since 1989, all these, of course, new potential NATO members, in Eastern Europe. And what have we done? We've gotten small little temporary bases, and sometimes they're like seasonal bases or ready-to-go, bare-bones bases. And we've got lots of bilateral military relations going on with a lot of these countries, Poland, what's some of the others, Romania, Hungary, these countries. So we have been for a long time looking for a place to put American bases that would allow us a little more freedom of movement and that kind of thing. So, I think that when Yugoslavia came apart, it was due to almost an inevitability with the death of Tito. I mean, the way that he was able to hold that country together. At the same time, the United States has been extremely opportunistic about that, and we have several permanent bases in both, not just Kosovo, but in Bosnia. So, and those bases are not going anywhere, and to some extent, those bases provide a relief for operations that we can in formerly Eastern Europe countries, because they have less environmental restrictions. Their people aren't really out there complaining about the noise. They're glad to get the business, so they're not complaining about the airplane noise. Unlike Germany. And, of course, as Germany is sitting there along with France being like the major enemy now, right, because they didn't support the United States. They didn't support George Bush on his unilateral decision to invade and occupy Iraq. So we intend to shift our footprint. And I think in that article, and I've written other articles which also bring this up, we are looking at changing the global footprint. This fits in with neoconservative worldviews. It fits in with some of the empire-building things that they're looking at doing. It fits in with security for Israel, which is important, and it fits in with energy flows, both gas and oil energy flows. Because if you look at where our new footprint is going, it's moving east from Europe and south. Okay, we almost have a ring of bases now. If you count the Bosnian, Kosovo, you go over to go further east to the Kazakhstans and the Uzbekistans and the Afghanistans, okay? And then you come around full circle and you've got those bases in Iraq. Now, we always had the bases in Kuwait. We have a nice big base down in Qatar, and now you did. But in a couple other locations in Qatar, we can pull out of Saudi Arabia now. We got our four bases in Iraq. We have encircled the oil and gas zone and basically can do whatever we want to do for the next 35 years. They say the Chinese plan long-term. I think the neoconservatives plan long-term, too. Not that they advertise that to the American people, but that's what they're doing.
That's very interesting. And actually, it sort of sounds to me like something that's a bigger agenda than the neoconservatives. I mean, To some degree, the mainstream American establishment has allowed these neoconservatives to become the forefront of American policy, right?
Well, and I'll tell you, the other thing about neoconservatives is about half of them are registered Democrats. Okay, so when we say neoconservatives, people think, oh, well, that's part of George Bush's Republican Party thing, you know, some of the guys that used to work for Reagan. No, that's not true. Richard Perle's a registered Democrat, okay? Paul Wolfowitz was a Democrat until he switched parties back in, I think, 1980 or so. So a lot of them come from a American Democratic Party tradition. Some come from the traditional Republican Party. But the views are held custom. And I'll tell you an interesting thing. Watch what Lieberman says at these debates and what Lieberman is saying as he runs. I mean, Lieberman's a Democrat, right? He thinks he's going to run for president. So he's out there talking. He has pretty much the neoconservative worldview in the things that he's saying. He thinks that being in Iraq is not necessarily a bad thing. Certainly he didn't like, no one likes to be lied to in order to go to war, but once we're there, we might as well make the best of it, right? So that's what they're saying. And there's a number of the Democratic candidates that basically have that complacent view that, well, now that we're there, let's make the best of it. And the making the best of it is precisely what was intended. Okay? And this is all really awful because the Americans that die and the Iraqi people that die, and there's a number of Iraqi people that have been dying. Of course, we're not counting them, you know. We're not counting the Iraqi deaths. They're not important to us. But the deaths of Americans even over there, this is an acceptable cost to the neoconservatives. Most of them have never worn a uniform, and most of them don't have kids in the military. So it's really acceptable for them to send other people's children over there to basically secure the empire. And I happen to think that's awful.
When you wrote back in September, I don't know what the numbers are now, but back in September you wrote that 4,500 soldiers had been brought back as, quote, physically or mentally ill.
That's right, and that was reported in the Washington Post. I put a link on everything. When I use a number like that, I link to the article. And sometimes I link to articles that are more obscure, but that particular linkage went right back to the A section of the Washington Post. If that's indeed true. Now, that's not something that the Department of Defense is playing up. You know, they're not going to talk to you about 4,500 that came home, and there's probably more since then. They're not going to talk to you about people that have had mental breakdowns. They're not going to tell you about people that are getting sent home for insubordination or acts unbecoming, okay, because you get that with stress. They're not really, really talking so much about the accident rate, which happens when you're both under stress and you're not getting enough sleep and maybe you're limited on water and the temperature is 120 degrees. You get an increase of an accident rate. And they're not talking about that. In fact, it's interesting because I think antiwar.com just recently had an article where they talked about how they were actually dividing the deaths into combat deaths and non-combat deaths, and then they were just reporting combat deaths, not the other deaths. And what had happened when they changed their policy, which just happened in September, I guess, when they changed that I guess in August they had one number of combat deaths, and then they actually dropped like 35 or 40 when they gave the number the next time they reported it. And that's why certain people noticed it and started to look to see what they were doing. So they're definitely... The Department of Defense Public Affairs side of the House and the neoconservatives are definitely trying to play down the impact on our American soldiers and our military. You know, I wondered about the firefighting going on out west, okay? Normally what you have is when these fires start, you get the Guard and Reserve and active duty to come out and help. And they are helping, but they only started helping on the 29th of October. And there was just a Marine unit that got involved in firefighting just this past week, and I heard on the radio they said these guys would have been involved sooner, but they were deployed, and they just got back. First day they're back, they're going to fight fires. So there is huge impact in trying to have an empire, which is what the neoconservatives would like to have. Huge impact, and it needs to be accounted for, and it needs to be discussed, and American people need to wake up. And that doesn't even, I'm not even talking about the $87 billion that nobody has that we're going to pay to, pay to American contractors. I'm not even talking about the cash cost. I'm talking about the non-money cost.
Yeah, I mean, the idea that the National Guard and the people who are supposed to, you know, help out with floods and wildfires, the fact that they're all over thousands of miles away in the desert.
Yep. Well, I don't have the precise numbers. I do know that Northern Command on the 29th or 30th made an announcement that they were sending some help. But I'm just telling you, you know, the Guard and Reserve in particular are stretched thin. The active duty are stretched thin. The Army itself has a huge problem. And the problem's going to get worse when folks come back and they get a chance to re-up for another 4 or 5 years and they decide they're not going to do that. when the Guard and Reserve guys from the Army particularly come back and get their chances to re-up and they say, no, I'm not going to do that, we're going to have big problems. And this is because, and I'll tell you why, this is because Americans don't believe in an American empire, okay? Americans, the average American, has no interest in an American empire, okay? But the neoconservatives want that, and guess what? They're giving it to us, whether we wanted it or not.
Let me ask you, oh man, I didn't do my homework for this. I don't remember the name on this, but there was an article in Esquire, and if you've never heard of it, then I'll just skip right past it.
Okay.
There was an article in Esquire last February called The Pentagon's New Map, and it was written by a guy who supposedly was a high-level policy planner in the Pentagon, where he divided the world in like three groups. He said you have the core, which is like the G8.
Okay.
And then you have the scene states, which is like Brazil and India and Turkey and China and the countries that have mid-sized economies and China.
Uh-huh.
They play along with the Security Council and with the World Trade Organization, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And then there's a gap, and then you have the rogue states. And
the rogue
states? And our goal is to shrink the gap, expand the core, and eliminate the rogue states and force them all into the international community, what do you call the permanent disarmament regime. And really, to be frank, world government. And I wonder, this to me doesn't sound like particularly a neoconservative thing. This sounds like the kind of thing that the entire establishment seems to be geared around.
Mm-hmm.
And that maybe they're giving promise to the neocons just because the neocons are so vicious, they're willing to really take the steps necessary to get this done.
Yeah, you know, I think you're onto something there. And I didn't read the Esquire article, but it does in many cases go beyond what we call in this country a political sect of neoconservatives. It goes beyond that. If you look at the interest, the money interest, the big money, and I'm talking about billion and trillion dollar interest in things like world government. World government sounds so sinister, but things like this disarmed community, things like this expansion of the core and the elimination of rogue states, you know, to introduce a kind of controlled, centrally controlled stability across the globe. This is consistent with what the neoconservatives are looking for, but you're very correct. You can't just say, oh, that's a neoconservative idea, because there is a huge amount of international, global, moneyed interest, elite, sort of a global oligarchy that is very interested in that. This is what continues their, oligarchy, basically. It helps their oligarchy stay secure. And it involves, a lot of folks from a lot of different countries. I mean, if you look at the, you know, remember Russia when they sold off everything, they privatized the, you know, a long time ago, 80 years and 90 years ago, Soviet Union nationalized, right? When they had their big communist revolution.
Sure.
And it was kind of pre-industrial. It was very slow on the industrial at the time that they nationalized, but they nationalized everything. And then when the wall came down in 89, that next 6 years, 7 years, still going on, they privatized. But did you see who got it all?
Former KGB guys?
Well, yeah, and certain sets of families and influential politicians and their extended groups. Basically, you have a Russian elite, a Russian oligarchy, which is a financial and business and political oligarchy. In fact, there's a conflict now going on. I read about between, I'm sure there's been other conflicts, and this is probably a foundation conflict, probably been going on for a while, between the Putin people, okay, the people that Putin has helped enrich, and they've helped enrich Putin, and the people that, who was the old guy before that stood up in the tank?
Yeltsin.
Okay. So there's the Yeltsin oligarch. Okay. So you got the Yeltsin oligarch and the Putin oligarchs, and they're having a little conflict. In fact, the reason I read about this was it was in one of the major papers. One of the Putin put one of the Yeltsin oligarchs in jail, I think, or took, oh, I know, renationalized some of the Yeltsin oligarch owned stock. Okay. Renationalized just that stock. Kind of to even things out a little bit. So there's competition between these sects or these parts of the oligarchy. But that's just Russia. This story continues on when a lot of nations are either nationalized or privatized. You have certain groups that are enriched by this. The average people, you know, the average guy with four or five kids and a wife and three jobs trying to put food on the table, his life stays equal to or worse. His life is the, you know, this is what all the anti-war leftists are all about, you know, the poor people, okay? Their life doesn't really change, but the money transfers back and forth amongst these oligarchs. If you look at this, you'll see, you know, you can find plenty of evidence for this. And so it is in their interest in some ways to have a little more predictability, because isn't that what we all want when we have money in the bank, right? We have investments. We want to be able to know what's coming down the road. Dictatorships throw in unpredictability, right? Because you can't control the guy. You don't know what he's going to do. So therefore, they must get rid of him. It all sounds good. It's all sold in this idea of more democracy. You know, nobody wants to be under a dictatorship. But if you look at what's behind that, you know, it has nothing to do with what's good for the people. It has nothing to do with democracy. Look at Iraq today. Where's the democracy in Iraq? It's been 7 months since we went in and got rid of Saddam Hussein, okay? And then we killed his boys, too. There's no people. There's no Saddam guys and Ba'ath Party guys in power. Where's their democracy? No, they have Jerry Bremer.
Well, yeah,
Jerry Bremer's their little prince, their king. And he's not even one of them. He's one of us.
If we did set up a democracy, they'd just elect another Ayatollah, right? I mean, Shia are the majority there.
Well, that's right, and we don't want them to do that. So therefore, they don't get democracy. They don't get democracy until we can figure out a way to prevent it from being the kind of democracy that will go against our interests, okay? And so basically what you're really looking for is a puppet government, if you could have one, kind of like Karzai in Afghanistan. But see, Karzai has a problem because he can't leave the city, you know, because he'll get killed by the other folks that live in Afghanistan. So he has a problem. But, you know, ideally we could have a puppet government in Iraq. That would make them happy. Then we could say, oh, well, we'll give you parliamentary elections, but the head guy has to be somebody that Jerry Bremer likes, or somebody that George Bush or Rumsfeld or Wolfowitz like. And, so we're not interested in democracy. So anyone should never be confused don't be dismayed. I mean, it's just a word. It's a word the neoconservatives use, and it means nothing to them. And it's not what they want, okay? What they want is what they already have, four big bases, changing of the footprint, and one more step in this increased control and therefore predictability in the global markets, global economic situation. The people really don't matter, and you got to look beyond the people, because people don't matter to these people. I know this sounds crazy, but I'm telling you.
Oh, I'm with you.
if you read up on these folks and you look at what they're doing and you sit back and hear the words that they say, I mean, you know, the situation in Iraq is getting worse, okay, as far as guerrilla warfare. They're getting more successful. As all guerrilla warfare happens over time, they figure out where you're weak and they know how to exploit those weaknesses. You really can't win. You can kill a lot of people, and we are capable of doing that, but you can't win a guerrilla war like that on their own countryside. We already know this. And what is George Bush saying, though, in the face of that? He says, well, the reason why they're killing more of our people and attacking, that just shows we're succeeding. That's what he said. He said, that means we're succeeding. And he says, all our soldiers out there that are wearing a big target on their chest, they're just taking the war to the terrorists, you know, so that we don't have to have them here in the United States. Well, this is totally bogus.
Well, what's the matter with you? Don't you have the new copy, the 11th edition of the Newspeak Dictionary?
I guess I need to get it.
This all makes perfect sense. Let me ask you about a split that, I don't know, because I'm actually very cynical about the idea that the neocons are really something that much separate mm-hmm. from the rest of the Wilsonians in mm-hmm. American foreign policy circles. Mm-hmm. But one split that I do see that seems pretty stark is, for example, Greg Pallas at the Guardian and the BBC has written mm-hmm. at length about the Bush family's connections with the Saudi royalty and with the mm-hmm. Bin Laden family, and how, because of the oil contacts and what have you, that he is trying very hard, and, you know, the oil interests within the Republican Party are trying mm-hmm. very hard to protect Saudi Arabia, whereas it seems like the neoconservatives, on the other hand, would very much like to foment a coup and have an excuse for us to invade Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I wonder, where do you see that split exactly, and who do you think is winning?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, I don't know who's winning, but I think on that split part, you know, the Bush family ties that go way back, and not just the Bush family, but many American business families have ties with Saudi Arabia, not just the Bushes, although the Bush family is out there, I mean, you can read about that. What that represents, I think, is really what we're talking about earlier with the moneyed oligarchy. You know, the business that goes on around the world, with basically, you know, trillions of dollars flowing back and forth, and, of course, Saudi Arabia at one point had huge amounts of money, and so they were the friend that people wanted to have. I mean, you know, when we remember under Reagan, and we helped freedom fighters against communism around the world, different places, Nicaragua and all these places, countries like Saudi Arabia helped immensely in money flows. Even if our Congress wouldn't give money for this or that, Saudi Arabia would say, well, if you're interested in this, I can, you know, we can do this. And they would help out. So there's a lot of back scratching going on. And that interest is, I think, persistent. You know, the persistent interest between the very, very wealthy oligarchs, not so much the countries themselves, but in the case of Saudi Arabia, the, you know, the sheikdoms or whatnot who are running that country now. If those sheikdoms were overthrown in some way due to some kind of upright, you know, some kind of movement or shift in Saudi Arabia, because the people in Saudi Arabia are very frustrated. You know, the average Saudi Arabian is not making the money he used to make, as high unemployment, a lot of unemployed men. And they have some concerns. They see the sheikdoms that are running their country as being very corrupt and very, very not honoring Islam and that kind of thing. So if those folks went down the tubes, then what would we do? If Saudi Arabia was still pumping oil and making lots of money, I think we'd try to make friends with whoever was in charge. Okay, so it wouldn't be Bush's old friends. They'd be dead already, but or in other countries. But we'd still be interested in following the money. You see what I'm saying? The folks that need to do this business of international banking and scratching each other's back and increasing the profits and that kind of thing, they would continue to do that if Saudi Arabia remained productive. Now, if they stopped pumping oil because all of a sudden they thought, you know, somebody, whoever is running it, said we don't want to do that, and they became poor, they would have very few friends amongst the oligarchy, okay, unless, you know, we decided we wanted to force them to turn the pumps back on. I mean, they could go do that. So there's that. Now, the neoconservatives, in many ways, the ones that we're seeing in Washington today, they are, you know, there's a mix of folks that you can identify as the in-power neoconservatives in the Washington circle. Most of them, if not all of them, but most of them, really do look at Israel's interests as being the same as the United States' interests. They don't often say that. Sometimes they do say that. Okay, they see Israel as our friend, the reliable democracy in the Middle East. And they often will refer to Israel as the only democracy in the Middle East, which is not, of course, necessarily true. But that's often how you'll hear them refer to Israel. So they see Israel in this whole kind of superficial goal of spreading democracy. They see Israel as important, and certainly security to this little democracy that we have in the Middle East is something that drives them. Saudi Arabia is a threat to that. Okay, so that's why a lot of neoconservatives seem very vicious towards countries like Saudi Arabia, countries like Iran, and certainly Syria, because they see those countries as being enemies of this little threatened democracy in the middle of the Middle East, the only one, which they view it as the only one, and they view it as being threatened and constantly under attack. And who's attacking it? Saudi, Iran, and Syria. So you see this kind of demonization of these countries, even though Iran is halfway to a democracy itself, even as we speak. Of course, you know, the State Department policy to Iran is, we're working with them, okay, because they're doing all the right things for the most part, even to consenting to these the IAEA inspections. I mean, they're basically doing all the right things. So the State Department view towards Iran is, we can work with them. The neoconservative view towards Iran is, it is threatening Israel's democracy. It's threatening Israel, and therefore we need to do something about it. So the subset of globalists, of world government type folks that you might be thinking about, the subset that is neoconservative is willing to take down these countries because they have a very important goal, which is preserving the security and the democracy of this little tiny country called Israel.
Wow, so in a way, it might almost be, well, I mean, I don't know, there's pros and cons and goods and bads, but mm-hmm. to the degree that the neoconservatives are willing to wreck some of the previously built structures for world order, they mm-hmm. might actually be doing us a favor to some degree, maybe.
Well, in fact, certainly they believe that they are. They believe that they are, okay? You know, you go and look at the neoconservative and say, you know, he's just a destructive chaos lover, okay? Because while they love chaos, they feel that the chaos that they're inflicting is eventually going to be for a higher purpose. The concern that I have is that the higher purpose, in their view, relies on a superpower to kind of enforce things. And guess who the superpower is? It's the United States. Well, that's fine. But, you know, we're a democracy. Okay, we have a constitution. We're a constitutional republic. Okay, and when we decide on what this country is going to do in the rest of the world, when we decide in particular that what we're going to do is contrary to the advice given to us by the founding fathers, which was to honor treaties. Isn't that what I think that we were supposed to honor treaties that we signed into? We were supposed to be basically a country that had many, many friends, a country that was, you know, a light on a hill. Maybe people wanted to be like us, who were going to preserve people's freedom, God-given right, you know, that was going to be preserved. The Bill of Rights is there not because the government gave us rights, but because the founding fathers said God gave us these rights and the government can't take them away. I mean, so that's why they put them down there. So it's fine that the neoconservatives think that they're doing everyone a favor, regardless of the chaos and the destruction and the death that they cause. They feel that it's all worthwhile. They're very much the ends justify the means. And that's fine, but since their vision requires that the United States be the ruling superpower, the empire master, okay, since their vision requires that, in fact, if you read our national security strategy, it says we will not allow a near-peer competitor. We will not allow the rise of someone equal to us in terms of military power. So that's very interesting, okay? Now, American people, if they want to do that, fine, we're a democracy. Put that before the American people and let them talk about it. Let them see if this is what they want to do. You know, we can reinstate the draft. You know, we can do lots of things in order to satisfy this neoconservative world vision. The problem is they never ask the American people, okay? It's not anything. It's not remotely anything what George Bush ran on when he ran. That's the last time he was talking about it. He's not talking about it very much in his current campaign. Okay, he's talking about the war on terrorism, whatever that is, okay? But he's not talking about the United States as a global, as a leader of a global empire, that a global empire that it enforces with military strength and might, okay, which means American soldiers on the ground all around the world. And we're kind of halfway there, okay? So until the American people consider what's being put before them and decide that, yes, indeed, that's what we want to do. We want to make the world a better place by force with us on top, directing as a benevolent, not a dictatorship, but a benevolent master, kind of.
Oh, I remember Bill Kristol's piece in Foreign Affairs.
What do we call it?
Global hegemony.
Yes, benevolent hegemony, yes. We're going to be a benevolent hegemon, okay? And then Bill Kristol's a prime spokesman of neoconservatism. So he's serious when he says we're going to be a benevolent hegemon. He's very serious. The thing is, no president, the president that's currently serving, Mr. Bush, the people that are running against him, no one is clearly identifying to the American people that this is one of our options, to be a benevolent hegemon, and this is what it's going to cost us to do this, and we would like you all to buy in on that and send your sons and daughters into the military to serve in a constabulary function, basically, which is very different than a traditional defensive military, and then let the American people choose. Okay, and if they want to do it, hey, I'm just fine. I'll vote against it, and I'll go with the majority rule. No problem, right? Because I'm an American, and we'll all play our democracy game. But you know what? They didn't ask any Americans if they wanted to do this. Okay, in fact, they lied to America in order to get them into Iraq. Okay, they said this guy's going to attack us. They're going to put an atomic bomb in downtown Midwestern cities and blow y'all up. We got to get rid of this guy. No, none of that was true. Okay, it was all a big lie. To do what? To get Americans thinking in a traditional defensive mode, as we would normally, and say, okay, Mr. President, you go defend this country. Well, going into Iraq had nothing to do with defending this country. It had everything to do with pursuing the neoconservative agenda, which has never been sold or even advertised to the American people. And this is very upsetting to me, as you might can tell, by the way I'm talking. I find it very upsetting.
And by the way, you're right, which is great. What do you say to someone who says, yeah, but look, you know, there's this tiny percent of radical Islamics and they've taken over Islam and they have war against us and we got to take it to them and kick ass and show them and maybe I don't like Bush and I don't like the neoconservatives, mm-hmm. but we've got to have bases over there to mm-hmm. protect us from the terrorists and that kind of mm-hmm. thing. How do you answer that?
Well, first off, the billions and billions of Muslims around the country are not being taken over in any sense of the word by radical terroristic Islam, okay? The Wahhabi sect has always been relatively small, and even when it tries to sell its ideas, it has trouble, okay? They go down to, they have lots of Wahhabist schools, I forget what they call those Muslim schools. There's lots of them all over. Say again?
The madrasas.
Yes, the madrasas, and They have them in lots and lots of places. And, you know, especially in Africa, which is a place that, you know, you have a lot of Muslims. There's kind of a Muslim belt. They're glad to get the education because African governments aren't providing any education. So they're glad to get that education. But you know what? They don't buy into this. They get you guys are nuts. So they don't buy into it. So the Wahhabists have a problem. First off, they don't interpret the Quran the way most people interpret the Quran. That's number one. Number two, they're not offering real solutions to people that live in Islamic countries. So it doesn't sell on the merits of its ideas. In fact, they're very much like the neoconservatives. Okay? The neoconservatives went out and tried to sell their ideas. Most Americans would say, excuse me, but I don't want any of that. That's what they say to the Wahhabists also. So regardless of how the Wahhabists, the power of these radical Muslims is built up, the vast majority of Muslim people have nothing to do with it. They know what's in the Quran, and they know what their religion teaches, and they're happy with it, and they live with it the best they can, and they try to honor their religion. Okay, they're not out being terrorists. Okay,
that's hilarious.
One thing.
I like that. Wahhabists, the neocons of the Middle East.
To me, they're the same. To me, they're very similar. They run on a parallel track. They have a very obscene and extreme agenda, and when they try to sell their agenda straightforwardly, what happens is people reject it, okay? So they don't. So therefore, what do? They don't do it. They don't do it straightforwardly. They bomb people. If you're a Wahhabist, if you're a Bin Laden, what do? You blow up things. Get a big attention. You get a bunch of angry young men to work with you, and you go ahead and do that. You get attention that way. And then your conservatives take over countries when they never ask the American people if we should do such a thing. So anyway, to me, they're the same thing. But it's, at least they're equal in their caliber. But the other thing about terrorism is, what George Bush uses the word war on terrorism, that just doesn't fit. Okay, first off, you can't have a war on something that is intangible. Second, it is intangible. I mean, you have a terrorist attack here, you have a terrorist attack there, you have freedom fighters here. We have Chechens fighting the Russians, right? Which ones are those? Are those terrorists? Well, they are to the Russians.
Probably both sides of the
country. That's right. Both sides are, you know, it depends on how you look at it. So what George Bush refuses to do, and the neoconservatives definitely refuse to do this, is to look at what causes people to be very, very angry, such that they will take extreme risk to themselves and their families and conduct violent acts, including suicide attacks. Now, think about when we decided to take our country from the British. Basically, we're a British colony. They had tons of British people here, including lords and all kinds of people that had been granted huge titles of property. And but finally, at some point, after a couple hundred years of this, we say, you know, getting a little tired of this. And about a third of the people in America didn't have anything to do with it. A third of the people sided with Great Britain, and a third of the people decided to be freedom fighters, okay? And they were we conducted ourselves. We fought that war in an insurgent way, in a guerrilla way, and in a way that was viewed by the Brits as terroristic. Okay? That's what we did. And that's what people do when they get angry enough and they want to do something. There has to be a reason for it. We had a reason. Osama bin Laden has some reasons. You know, are they valid? Who knows? But he has reasons for what it is that he's doing. The people in Iraq who are cheering, okay, and the people, the average people, the so-called liberated Iraqis who aren't really liberated, but we told them they were, they cheer when American soldiers are injured, and when American tanks are blown up. They are bystanders to this act. They didn't conduct the act, but when they see it happen, they cheer. They say, hey, go away, go home, we don't need you here, right? Why are they saying that? There's a reason why they're saying this. Now, George Bush is not interested in those reasons. Okay?
Well, hang on one second. Let me stop you right there, because I know somebody's driving around, and is just tuning in, and is thinking, who is this commie? And I just want to point out that, you know, this lady writes for LouRockwell.com and just retired from the Pentagon.
After 20 years. So I'm a conservative. I'm a paleo-conservative. I just have a real problem with the neoconservative worldview, because it's not anything like the conservatism that I grew up with.
Yep. I just want to make the point that you're not some commie out there hating America first and trying to defend Osama bin Laden.
Oh, no. But the thing is, if you call a person a terrorist, terrorism is an act, okay? It's an act that anyone, in fact, you know, in this country where we talk about rape, you know, and it used to be rape was kind of like an act of sex, but then what we came to understand is, no, rape is an act of violence, and it's like terrorism, right, against a person. This terrorism is an act, okay? Acts of terrorism happen. Terrorism is not this global evil that's something you can make this war against. What you have to do is you deal with the criminal act of the actual whatever it is, bombing or whatever, this is a criminal act, a violation of law. You deal with it in those terms, in terms of a criminal act. If the criminal act seems to be something that's connected to a political ideology, which it isn't in this case, the terrorism, you know, George Bush liked to tell you, terrorism is a bunch of Islamics who want to make everybody, you know, an Islam, you know, a Muslim, and that has nothing to do with what they're doing. They have political and economic grievances, particularly, and it all kind of ended up coming down to the Israeli-Palestine situation. But Arabs, in particular, and many, many people who are Muslims, particularly in the Middle East, where they see injustice and they see these Western propped up oligarchies in charge of their own countries, whether it's a dictator like Saddam, who was a friend of ours for many, many years, as you know, or guys like the House of Saud, which is, you know, basically corrupt, and the people in Saudi Arabia are frustrated with that, and yet it's a great friend of the George Bush family. So, you know, they're very frustrated with what they see as injustice. And so, yeah, sometimes they commit terrorist acts. Okay, can you have a war on terrorism? No. You can punish particular acts, and you can hunt folks down. If Osama bin Laden's in 911, we need to get him and do something to him, which is why we're in, ostensibly, why we're in Afghanistan, but isn't it interesting that we still haven't gotten him? So there's that. But, you know, you have to look at what is driving this. Because, you know what? Every kid, every son of a father that American soldier shoots in Iraq, his whole family, any one of his kids can grow up and look for revenge. Okay? If somebody's sister is killed accidentally, or a baby, a child is killed, there are huge extended families there ready to seek revenge. And to call that, and if they seek revenge in a way that they commit a crime, we could call it terrorism, but we have to treat it for what it is. It has a source, it has a cause, it has a reason. Okay? That's not a justification, but that's a way to understand it. Now, if you can understand it, guess what? You can manage it. You can control it. And you know what? You might even be able to win the war on terrorism if you're willing to look at why it happened. Okay? George Bush is not willing to look at why it happened. He says, those people just hate Americans. That's the stupidest thing I ever heard.
Well, okay.
You know?
well,
they don't hate Americans.
And George Bush says a lot of things that are the stupidest things
that's
we
true.
Ever heard.
Well, that
but
is
what about,
true.
But Wolfowitz isn't stupid. And Wolfowitz, I think, probably understands what you just explained. So that,
yeah, he does, but...
This is all on purpose. This is a really great excuse to have a perpetual state of war in the Middle East.
Well, it is. It
the
is.
The more we do, the worse it gets, the more we do.
That's right. And it's worse to... And that's the unfortunate thing about new conservatives. People like Paul Wolfowitz. Wolfowitz is a very intelligent man. He understands what I just said very well. And he would not even argue with me on the points that I'm making. Okay, because he understands what I'm saying is true. This is how you really... understand the situation of terrorism, but he's willing to let it go, not worry about why, react to it in a militaristic fashion, which is the way George Bush is intending to react to it. I mean, he says, yes, we're staying, we're going to win this war. I don't care if we have to kill every Iraqi, we'll win this war. That fits in with the vision that the neoconservatives have for the Middle East, which is a friendly Iraq, by hook or by crook, whether that friendly Iraq is our hand-picked leader, whether that friendly Iraq is a Balkanized state, and we have, secure concrete concertina wire surrounded military outposts in various parts of Iraq, and the whole country around is basically a Somalia, really it doesn't matter to the neoconservatives. I mean, ideally, they would like to have a single state, everything's hunky-dory, and they have a friendly governor, and he lets us do whatever we want. That's ideal. But if we can keep our bases and everything else in Iraq falls apart, goes to hell in a handbasket, is basically, you know, Mogadishu, but we don't have to go into the city. We can just stay and go, we can bypass the city. That's fine. Because this is about a larger issue than what's good for Iraq. If it was about what was good for Iraq, we would have let the Iraqi people take care of Saddam, one way or the other, or wait him out. Okay? Because Saddam was 65 years old. Just a matter of time. But we couldn't control that. If we had let Iraq go in the direction it was probably going to go, we would not only have not been in on the business once the sanctions were lifted, and they were due to be lifted relatively soon. Okay, and we would have got any of the business. It would have all gone to European and Russian and Chinese companies, none to the Americans or the Brits. So once we would have not only lost that business opportunity, and he had already switched to the euro for his oil, so we would not have been, he wouldn't have been selling his oil on the dollar. Okay, we wouldn't have been able to control that at all. Plus, we would have no idea if the country goes to a Shia type Islamist country, if it breaks up into three parts. You know, we would have no say over and no influence over how that happen. So the best thing to do is preemptively, and this is why they went preemptively, to preemptively go in there and add some control to the situation. And it worked for, in the United States' neoconservative interest in changing our military footprint such that we can threaten the neighbors and exercise even more control. It's not about the Iraqi people. It's never been about them. It's very sad.
Our hour's up, but the next guy isn't here, so if you want to
stay
on, I'm more than happy to keep this going. I got
Are you sure the next guy's not there?
No, I ain't here yet. I'm willing to keep on going until he shows up, if you are.
Sure, fine. We'll do it.
Let's see. I'm not sure. I think I read this out of an article that you wrote, or at least an article about you. Anyway, something about how Syria had been trying to cooperate with us as far as arresting al-Qaeda people and turning them over to us.
Yes.
And how there was a bombing in June on the Syrian side of the border that it was suspected that the neoconservatives had deliberately done this to sabotage the State Department's expanding relations with Syria. Is that right?
Well, I think you might be referring to Cy Hirsch's article in The New Yorker, which talked a great deal about this. Yeah, because the Syrian, in fact, you know, leading up to the war, even Syrian intelligence had been helpful to us. But the neoconservatives don't want Syria to be a U.S. ally. They actually want Syria to, I think they want Syria to go away as a nation state. I'm not sure. But they definitely were not interested in working with Syria. But Syria is interested in working with us. And, you know, they're Assad, who runs Syria now, he's the son, you know, remember the son of the other guy who died, I guess. And this guy, I think he's like an ophthalmologist or some kind of medical. He's in the medical field, right? And that's what he was doing until he came in as the president. So he's a little bit on the westernized side. You know, he's Western educated in Britain, I think. And he is a modern guy, and now he's in charge of Syria because they don't really have a democracy, right? So he's in charge. And, you know, he's definitely interested, he had been definitely interested in moving towards making his country a cooperative country, getting his country off of the rogue states list that State Department has. At the same time, he has lots and lots of Syrians there who have their own views about what how Syria should behave. So, you know, while he's a monarch in a way, he has to listen to the people a little bit, you know. In fact, it's interesting how if you look at the history of monarchies, they usually do have to listen to the people. Well, he listens to the Syrian people, and he has to walk a fine line between what the Syrians want and how the Syrians feel about their situation and their role, okay, and what the West wants. And he's very aware of what the West would like, and he's very aware of stability issues and all kinds of things. Well, anyway, neocons don't like him regardless. They didn't like the other guy, and they don't like him. And, you know, Syria's on the chopping block. And there's been a huge fight on the subject of Syria between the neoconservative Pentagon political appointees and the State Department. And I'm not sure who's winning, but the Cy Hirsch article in the New Yorker from a couple months ago went into a great deal of detail on how some of the things that had been pushed by the neoconservatives shot any kind of helpful diplomacy that we had going on in the foot. And they very much intended, I think, to go into Syria shortly after they went through Iraq. But because Iraq didn't work out, wasn't the cakewalk that they expected, they were forced to stop, and they could not go into Syria. We did go into Syria, you know, some of our special forces and some other military folks went into Syria, but that had to be stopped because of the way things had actually ended up after the invasion in Iraq.
Wow, so you think they really thought it was going to be a cakewalk?
Well, here's, you got to realize, these guys, these neoconservatives only talk to other neoconservatives, okay? So it's not like they have a B team. It's not like they have a devil's advocate that can sit there and say, well, you know, let's flip this 180. What would be your plan if? Okay. Well, whenever somebody said, what would be your plan if, the answer from the neoconservatives was, well, that's not going to happen because Ahmed Chalabi says that all of the Iraqis are dying to be liberated and they want America to do it and they love us and therefore don't worry about that. It's not going to happen. Well, that's not very productive because what happened is because they didn't listen to the intelligence community. The intelligence community had plenty of information on the kinds of things that might happen. But if it didn't fit into their paradigm, okay, which was the cakewalk paradigm, it didn't get listened to. They didn't feel that they had to respond to it. Now, to a large extent, to the extent that things went well with the invasion per se, and to the extent that anything goes well with the occupation, you can give credit to the folks at Central Command, okay? Whether that's Tommy Franks or the guy in charge of Central Command now. The military does listen to B teams. The military does look at worst case scenarios. The military does look at lessons learned, and they try to be prepared for the unexpected. Okay, that's the way the military works. And so to the extent that things haven't gone worse, you can give credit to Central Command. To the extent that things went to hell in a handbasket, you can give credit to the neoconservative civilian war planners who insisted on only listening to information that fit their paradigm. To me, it's criminal. As a military person, it's criminal, okay? It's just plain. I mean, we had McNamara. Remember McNamara? I mean, I didn't remember him. I read about him. We had McNamara during Vietnam, and, you know, he said, well, this is how it has to be, and if things didn't fit in his paradigm, he didn't listen to him.
He's the guy who came out and wrote a book a few years ago about how, hey, we knew that we were wrong all along, but we couldn't stop. Sorry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that was his second book. Do you know the story behind that?
No,
with
I don't.
With McNamara? Yes. Well, I don't know much of the story, but there's a book. McNamara wrote his memoir over that time period that he was the Secretary of Defense. He wrote his memoirs some years ago, okay, after he left the Pentagon, but some years ago. And he wrote his memoirs, and I don't know what the name of that book is. And then, military guy working on his PhD at Duke University, can't remember the guy's name, wrote a book called Dereliction of Duty. Okay, this book, Dereliction of Duty, was this guy's PhD thesis in history. Okay, and what he had done several years ago, 6-7 years ago, when he wrote his dissertation, he went through a bunch of recently declassified memos and records of meetings and discussions with the National Security Council, the Pentagon, the White House, and all this during the time of the Vietnam War and during the time of McNamara's reign as Secretary of Defense. He wrote this book, and it's a wonderful book, Dereliction of Duty, and very popular on military reading lists, okay? That's where I was exposed to it. He goes through, the guy doesn't pass judgment. What he does is he says, this is what, you know, he shows what was actually said and who said it and what they were doing at the time. And as you get to the end of the book, you're basically, your stomach is turning, okay, because of the politicization of intelligence and the politicization of the war and the lies that were told both within the military, within the political circles, and to the American people. I mean, it just makes you sick. This book, Dereliction of Duty, was reviewed, of course, and read about, and if you read it, it indicted severely McNamara. It definitely made McNamara out as one of the top two bad guys, okay? So the book comes out. What does McNamara do? Less than 1 year later, he comes out with Remembrance. That's his second book about what happened in Vietnam. His first book about what happened in Vietnam was how great it was, okay, and how he was right. His second book, Remembrance, was only written in response to Dereliction of Duty. Okay, so he had to come out again and defend himself, which he did. He came out and made a defense and that kind of thing. But in any case, you would think, with all the stuff we knew about that, that we wouldn't be seeing it happening again. And yet, we have many of the same things. You have politicization of intelligence. You have a group of people that are afflicted by groupthink. They are playing with the lives of American soldiers overseas in order to feed a fantasy of empire, a fantasy of the benevolent hegemon. There's no such thing as a benevolent hegemon. You find me one in history, you know, and you can prove me wrong, but there's no, I don't think historically we've ever had that. It's really difficult to be a benevolent hegemon unless you kill all your subjects. Okay?
Yeah, which makes you not very benevolent.
Well, but then if you have no people out there fighting you, then I guess you can say you're benevolent. Otherwise, you're a hegemon, and you threaten people, and you cause all the other people to be fearful of you. If you occupy foreign countries, you have a native population that is going to say, why are you here taking the wealth of my country, or whatever it is that you're doing, telling me how to live, you know, disrespecting my culture, disrespecting my religion? You know, what do you do? It is understandable. I'm not on the side of the terrorists. I'm telling you, if Saddam Hussein did invade Texas, what do you think the Texans would do? Can you imagine the response? What if Canada? What if the Quebecois decided they were going to take Michigan? Because they like Michigan. It's very similar to what they have in Quebec. I mean, they think they want that. Okay? And they said, well, we're going to take it. There's not many Michigan people living in northern Michigan. We just like cut off a piece. Well, what do you think the American people would do with that?
Grab our rifles and go to work.
You better believe it. You'd have folks from Florida with their rifles driving up in their pickup trucks to go kill Canadians, and it would be that quick. And Canada's our ally. You think it would switch like, you know, night and day if they did something like that? Of course it would. This is what people do when you come into their country. It's ludicrous that, well, anyway, it's just for us to say, oh, well, the Iraqis should bend over and be grateful for us because we're so much smarter than them and we're so much better than them. And we're going to give them democracy. Well, first off, we haven't given them any democracy, but we're saying we are, so that might get some points for saying it, right? No, no. You come into somebody's country, you start messing with their country. You don't understand their language. You don't understand their culture. You go into their houses and look at their women. They don't like that. Okay? It's understandable why they don't want us there. Same way we wouldn't want Canadians in northern Michigan. And, you know, there isn't a lot of people living in northern Michigan. Why not the hell just give it to Canada if they wanted it? Of course we wouldn't do that. Okay? We would not give it to them. Even if it was 10 people, you would have thousands of people driving up to defend those 10 people in northern Michigan. You know? And if you think about this in those terms, it becomes very understandable why global empire is not something that this country is cut out to do. Okay? It's not part of the American tradition. Americans don't want it. If you told Americans this is what we're going to do, Americans would not vote for it. Okay? The neoconservative position on foreign policy has never been put forth to the American people. They've never had an opportunity to say yay or nay. And yet we're going out and doing it. And I think people should wake up, see what's going on, and figure out a way to get rid of it. Now, you know, you want George Bush, I think he had to insist, if you're a Republican, he had insisted George Bush kind of purge his cabinet a little bit. Change his perspective to a more traditional conservative. If you think he's not going to do that, and you don't like George Bush, then vote for somebody else. I mean, but you got to do something.
Can you hang tight right there? I want to take a short little break, play a song mm-hmm. real quick, and switch mini discs.
Okay.
And I want to ask you about Tia and her 12 sisters.
Okay.
All right, cool. Hang tight real quick. We're going to play a song. Everybody, you're listening to Karen, and I'm going to pronounce your last name incorrectly again. What is it?
Katowski.
She runs for LouRockwell.com. She just retired from the Pentagon. And definitely check out her articles on Lou Rockwell. They're excellent. And we're going to play a song here real quick, take a short break, and we'll be right back on 95.9 FM Radio Chaos in Austin, Texas. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. We got just about another 10 or 12 minutes here before the next show. But I wanted to ask you about a column that you wrote about Tia and her 12 sisters. Now, I learned here in your resume that, well, let me get it right here. Let me see. You worked on the staff of the director of the National Security Agency at Fort Meade, Maryland, which means to mm-hmm. me that you must know quite a bit about pardon me, our national government's intelligence capabilities, especially in terms of electronic spying and that kind of thing. And mm-hmm. I wonder if you can explain to us somewhat briefly about the DARPA and the Total Information Awareness and the 12 sisters, as you call them, that go along mm-hmm. with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not an expert on it. You know, one thing, National Security Agency's charter prohibits them from, you know, listening in on American, you know, phone conversations or anything like that. They're prohibited from targeting Americans. I think they can't really, you know, the military, part of the military cannot do police duties, that kind of thing. NSA can't be involved in prosecuting domestic crime or that kind of thing. So they don't listen on American citizens. Even if the FBI would like them to, the NSA does not do that. It can't. Does have capability to do that? Yes. Okay, but their charter prohibits them, so I don't want to make it think like NSA is. A lot of people are worried about NSA, and certainly the capability is there, but the charter prohibits them from doing that. Now, in this age of the way information technology is, global internet, global, satellites bouncing, cell phones and the whole bit, I mean, it's very much hard to say if you're listening to something, would there be an American on the other end? Would there be an American in the States? Might you be getting something on international airways that was between two Americans? So they have to walk a fine line. But DARPA is not the same, of course, as NSA, you know, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. They're not like, I mean, they're different from NSA. And I'm not an expert on that. I never worked at DARPA. In fact, I got an email when I wrote that column. I got an email from a couple of folks who worked at DARPA who felt that I had been far too harsh. Which I wasn't really that harsh, I don't think, but they felt that I had been a little harsh on DARPA because they said, one person said, you know, I've worked at DARPA for, all my career, and I think DARPA is a great place, and I don't think they do bad things. And, you know, it's really not about DARPA doing bad things. It's about the ideas that DARPA can develop for domestic use, technical capabilities, that then will be used by any government at any level, whether that's state or local or federal, to do whatever the government decides it wants to do with it. So it really is an issue of privacy. It is an issue of the 14th Amendment, the 4th Amendment, the 1st Amendment, I think the 10th too, I'm not sure. There's a number of amendments that would be threatened in viability if you pursued this kind of capability and put it in the hands of the government, federal government or any other kind. Certainly the Defense Department, like NSA, which is part of the defense establishment, doesn't do law enforcement type things. We have a special waiver when we work with the Coast Guard, you know, when we go do drug busts and things like that over with the Coast Guard. The Navy may do all the work, but a Coast Guard officer comes up to arrest the person that they caught for the drugs, because the Coast Guard in peacetime has a domestic function, which includes a law enforcement function. So the military is very sensitive about not getting into law enforcement. But DARPA, what they were doing was basically down that slippery slope of technologies that can invade privacy and that can be used in such a way by the government that if some later date, whether it was 5 years from now or 20 years from now, you would have a population that would be basically totally subject to the federal government in all kinds of ways that we can't even imagine. And it's, again, it's contrary to American traditional values to have your government to be that empowered into things like what you're doing on your computer, okay, and who you're calling and what you're saying. You know, they have I forget on the different programs that are listed in there, TN or 12 Sisters, there were 13 programs under this terrorism information. What was the A for? Forget now, because they've closed
awareness.
It all down.
Awareness.
Initially it was terrorism information awareness, and there were 13 different programs.
First it was total information.
Oh, you're right. It was total information.
Terrorism.
Yes, that's right. They renamed it terrorism. That's exactly right. Because total information awareness certainly spoke to all the fears of the civil libertarians and the ACLU and all the folks that are concerned that the government has too much power already. When they said total information awareness for domestic, for American citizens, it was just people went crazy. And then, of course, they changed it to terrorism, which was no different, really, because now we're all terrorists because they're still going to get the information from everyone. They're just looking for terrorists. If they find stuff on you, you could be one. But, the interesting thing about that is that my article was one of just, thousands of articles of people exposing and discussing this whole thing. And, of course, John Poindexter, being an Iran-Contra figure, being brought back in a position like that, was already distasteful to the Congress. And what happened, what you saw, was actually a success, I think, of the system of government that we have here. The Congress actually acted. And initially what they did was they debated it, okay, which is what they're supposed to do. They should have done that last year on the Iraq War, but they didn't. But they debated this total information awareness, and they debated what was going on over there, these 13 programs, what was really the agenda, what was going to be the result, and they decided not to fund it. And initially it was a temporary, I think, block of the funding, and then eventually they killed the program. But initially they you couldn't kill it right away. They stopped the funding, they debated it, they stopped the funding, and then they killed it. So okay, it's like a gradual action on behalf of the American people, which is what we pay the Congress to do. And they just voted themselves a raise, so we're paying them even more to do that. So we really expect them to do their job. They did their job. They did their job with regards to the Total Information Awareness Program, and they basically pushed Rumsfeld in a position of having to relieve Admiral Poindexter from that position. And Admiral Poindexter, I'm sure, went back into civilian life, and he's not working there anymore, and he's not running that program, and those programs are not funded because Congress refused to fund those programs. And that's really a high point amongst many, many low points of the year 2002-2003, as we went into this war with Iraq, because they did everything they did for the Total Information Awareness at DARPA. They did not do for the war in Iraq, but at least it showed they could do it, didn't it? I mean, it proved that they could do something. And this program was part of something that George Bush kind of liked, it was part of Homeland Security, all this stuff, but they were still, Congress was still able to honor the Constitution more than they usually do and get rid of this. And so they can act, the Congress can be effective, and it can work on behalf of the American people, and it did that. And I'm glad, actually, that you brought that up, because people spoke out, Congress listened, They took legal action, which they're the legislative branch, and they took action to basically eliminate that, at least for now. It will come up again in future years, okay?
Well, you,
it will.
You hit the key right there. The people spoke out and mm-hmm. told their congressmen, look, man, if you don't kill this, you're fired.
That's right.
And their congressmen said, okay, I'll kill it. Don't fire me.
Yeah, true. And you know, what they did is when they complained to Congress and when these, and you know, the media also did their job. You notice how the media was extremely good about exposing what was going on with this total information awareness. Some would talk about John Poindexter, why is he back in government? Some would talk about the technology, you know, of this kind of thing. Some would talk about what it meant in terms of civil liberties, and some would talk about what it meant in terms of the Constitution. So we had lots and lots of people in the media, mainstream media, okay, ABC, CBS, NBC, you know, MSNBC, Fox, everybody is talking about this in the media, and they're getting it publicity. Who talked about should we or should we not go into Iraq? Who talked about the lies being told by the president and the vice president? Justin Raimondo, Antiwar.com, that's right. People, and Lou Rockwell, of course, but the mainstream media did not want to take the risk of being called an unpatriotic person. The mainstream media did not want to be told, if you don't like it, move to Canada, okay? They weren't willing to take that risk. They did not get called unpatriotic when they challenged the TIA, and therefore they did that. So they showed the media also served Americans in that, and they succeeded. The media exposed it. The people talked to their Congress. The people were interested in finding out what's going on. The media fed that interest, okay, and it all worked, and we got rid of it. For now. 5 years from now, it may come up again. But for now, we got rid of it. And that is a wonderful thing. Contrast that to what happened in the run-up to war. None of those things happened. The media, mainstream American media, ignored the fact that the president and the vice president were lying. You know, whenever they asked the hard question, they either got shut out of the press conference or ignored. President wouldn't call on them, or Rumsfeld wouldn't answer their questions, or Rumsfeld would try to humiliate them, or they were called anti-patriotic. Don't doubt for a minute that the editors of all the major print media and the guys that own the television media, including Murdoch, although they have to tell Murdoch because he's all on board with this, but these guys in the mainstream media were told, you know, if you want to get advertising, if you want to have the president, you know, be on your side on this and help you out in the future with whatever it is that you want, you better play the game. And they did play the game. So they don't have to. They didn't play it with TIA. We got rid of TIA because of that. System worked. They didn't do it with Iraq, and we had 130,000 men and women being shot at, being bombed, being, you know, victims of this insurgency that we caused. And we have no way of really bringing our boys home, boys and girls home. There's no real plan for doing that. We could do it. We should do it. But they don't have a plan. They're not talking about it. The media is still hobbled by this. You know, they're tied. They would like to ask hard questions, but they still are not out of their little shell. And so we're not even talking about the possibility of bringing our troops home. It is very, very easy to bring our troops home. You know that? We can bring our troops home.
Well, I was just going to ask you, if I could put you back at your desk in the Pentagon and tell you to write up a plan for an exit strategy, what would it be?
Mm-hmm. Plan for an exit strategy. I'd start bringing them home, and I would bring them home from the places. I wrote an article for Lou Rockwell about that. It's called, it's from a couple weeks ago.
The Secret of Al-Qut?
The Secret of Al-Qut tells you how to bring our troops home, because guess what? Al-Qut is a city in Iraq. Marines were there, and we brought them home. We brought them home, and we gave that city back to the Iraqis. There are some Ukrainians. There's some Ukrainians and some Polish peacekeepers, or whatever you want to call them, okay? And they are in Al-Qut. But you know what they do? They stay in their barracks, okay? They stay in their barracks. So when the time comes for the Ukrainians and the Poles to leave, people will wave to them, but otherwise they will not notice it, okay? They have their city back. This is the model, and I wrote about it because I think this is how you would do it. You would take those places where you can pull out, and you would set some targets, and you would say, we're going to have half our people gone by this date, half our people gone by that date. The places they leave first are the places that are easiest to leave, and the places they leave last are the places where they're actually doing some good, okay? And most places, I hate to say this, you know, because I know that our soldiers are doing good things. You know, they're trying to get, they're doing, you know, they're building schools or whatever it is that they're doing. You know, they're trying to keep order. But the fact of the matter is the Iraqis can do all of that, okay? There's not a thing that our soldiers are doing that the Iraqis can't do for themselves, not a single thing. And most of those things the Iraqis can do better. One reason they can do it better is because they speak the language, okay, that we don't. So there's really, you would pull the people out, you make your priorities on where you can get them out soonest, you move them out of there, and then you pull them out of the last place. You set a date, you set a target, and you'll honor it. It's that simple. Now, the neoconservatives will not tolerate this because their objective is to change the footprint in the Middle East, the military footprint, and we have four bases that we're building, maybe more, but I know there's four, that we don't want to leave. And so if I was going to compromise, and I'm not really in the mood to compromise, but if I was going to compromise and make a plan that would sell, I would allow the neocons their four bases. I'd still get the hell out of the rest of Iraq. And it can be done. It should be done. It's the right thing to do. Preemptive war to displace a dictator based on lies told to the American people and lies told to the Congress is a mistake. Okay? Once you make a mistake, you owe somebody some recognition, some reparation of that mistake. And the best thing we can do is to leave that country. It's actually a good time to do it now because supposedly, if you believe what Jerry Bremer says, and I'm not sure how much he says is true, but one of the things that he says is that we have replaced all of the, we've got back working all the power that we blew up and that was ransacked and whatnot. We have got that power capability, electrical power production capability. It's back now equal to or better than what Saddam Hussein had provided to his people prior to the invasion. Well, that's very nice. That's a kickoff. That's a stepping off point, okay? We have now repaired the damage that we have done. Need to pull out. And there's other things like that. But if national will was there, and of course, this is what Bush didn't understand. The national will soon be there to pull those troops out. Okay, as our soldiers start coming back and they tell their families and they tell their wives and their employers that they're reservists, they go back to their job, and let's pray to God they have a job to go back to. When they start talking to their friends and neighbors and family about what it's like, and then when they look at their, if they stay in the military and they look that they got to go back in 6 to 8 months or a year, this is going to become a very, very unpopular occupation. Okay? So the sooner George Bush figures that out and brings our folks home, the better it's going to be for everyone, including George Bush. So, there is every reason in the world to bring them home and very few reasons. And most of those reasons are part of a neoconservative agenda to keep them there. So, yeah, we can bring them home, and we should. And if I can tell you this, and I'm not even in the Pentagon, you can be sure that the planners in the Pentagon could figure out how to do it.
This has been an excellent last interview interview show. I'm so happy that you're going to get to go to the very top of the webpage, and you'll be sitting there for at least a couple of months. At the very top. Thank you so much for coming on the air today.
Okay, well, I'm glad you called me. I'm happy to be here.
Okay, now help me with your last name one more time. So
okay, Katowski.
Katowski. I don't know why I keep pronouncing all those silent letters there. Mary Katowski, recently retired Lieutenant Colonel in the United States Air Force. She writes for LewRockwell.com, and that's L-E-W, Rockwell.com, and I encourage everyone to go and read all of her articles. She writes even better than she speaks, and that's a hell of a thing. So thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Okay, well, thanks for having me.
Sure.